Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show, we're going to talk about the economy and how that inequality in our economy is affecting marriage and the family. This isn't a marriage and family show. This is about the economy and the real effects it has on the children of our next generation and how that affects our country. If the children do not get the resources they need to thrive and flourish and to learn, then that affects our ability to compete and to maintain our status in the world. Without that, we have serious problems with being competitive in a world economy where these other countries are way ahead of the game on education and resources for their children. So if we do not look at these problems, we're going to have some serious problems going up into the future. So I am going to welcome now June Carbone, who is the chair of the U of M Law School, and she wrote a new book talking about all these this subject. She has a large body of research on this. Her new book, Marriage Markets, was called by Newsweek as one of the most important books of 2014, and for good reason, and you'll hear it now. Let's welcome June Carbone to the program. Hi, June. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You have this wonderful book out called Marriage Markets, and you've been working on and studying this. Basically, half of marriage fails in this country, right? We're at a point where half of the marriages fail, and people have long blamed it on the moral decline of female empowerment. But you're taking a different look at this problem. You're looking at the economy. Can you please give us an overview of what you would say the Marriage Market book is about?
Sure, and let me explain it this way. Our prior book was called Red Families versus Blue Families. And we looked at how a family form, things like fertility, age of marriage, divorce rates, were different in different parts of the country. And the differences in family form correlate pretty closely with the vote. And we were thinking, wow, that, you know, we spent our last book writing about why that was true. But we knew some of what we were seeing was an increasing class divide. And so we wanted to get at that class divide. And let me give you just one example, divorce rates. So everybody hears this statistic that, you know, one out of every two marriages will fail. In fact, it's a little bit less than that now. But in the 90s, you began to hear, oh, the increase in divorce is leveling off. If you took a look at the numbers, though, divorce rates were not leveling off. They were dividing and moving simultaneously in two opposite directions. For college graduates, divorce rates are back to what they were in 1965, before the pill, before no-fault divorce. For everyone else in the 90s, they continue to go up. This is not anything leveling off. It is society moving in two completely different directions when it comes to family.
You talk a lot about classes in the book. What do you define as the classes?
We struggled with that. And the reason we did, and I'd like to emphasize we're lawyers, not sociologists. So we are playing off the statistical data that's there. And it collects most of the nationwide studies collect information in terms of college graduates, high school dropouts. So we take the college-educated middle class as the top group. Now, for marriage market purposes, who marries whom? Most of the studies are done in these terms. But, you know, if you live in Kansas City where I was living, college graduates really are their own group. If you're in D.C. where my co-author lives, it's really you have to divide college graduates from those with advanced degrees. But education is a pretty good proxy, especially for women. For men, income may be more important, or the mix of income and education. So we look at it a variety of different ways, but the basic groups we look at are We don't look at the 1% because when it comes to marriage, they're too small to be a significant group by themselves. But we look at college graduates. We occasionally look at the top 10% by income. We then look at people who graduate from high school but not college, or who attend college but don't finish, and then those who are high school dropouts. And sometimes we also look at things like poverty rates.
So it's essentially three different groups.
Yes. And they also divide by race. But when you talk about marriage, you do want to take a look at racial factors. So let me give you an example. If you look at New York City, which is an outlier in most respects, and you look at white male and female college grads, they're about equal in number, and the men out-earn the women. If you look at African American or Latino or Latina women in New York City, then the women outnumber the men, and the women have earnings that often out-earn the men. You get a very different picture. So when you want to get a feel for this, you want to look at who marries whom and how that affects things. You know, we try where we can to look at race, to look at religion, to look at geography, because you do get some differences. But in general, college graduates look a lot different from people who only graduate from high school now. And this is a really big change compared to, say, 30, 40 years ago.
Because the people who graduate from high school are pretty much what we've always defined as the middle class, right?
Yes. If you take the 50th percentile, it was very confusing. If you take the 50th percentile of people by income, they will have graduated from high school but not college. They may have attended community college, et cetera. But that's the 50th percentile of the country in terms of income. That is the middle.
Well, and the middle class has long been credited for building the country into the power that we've become. But your book really talks about the macroeconomic factors that are transforming our class structure and family life in a lot of fundamental ways. And these impacts can have some substantially long-lasting economic effects. How do you see some of this research and the stuff that you've been talking about affecting the country long-term, now and long-term?
Well, there's absolutely no question that one of the things that we talk about is how greater inequality interacts with the family. So on the one hand, we see greater inequality as one of the causes of the weakness of the family. That is the increase in family instability. On the other hand, when you look at the impact on children, the research is stunning. Let me give you one example. If you were to look at 1970, and you ask the question, how much time are parents spending with their children? There's almost no difference between somebody who graduates from high school and somebody who graduates from college. In fact, if you look at just the mothers who graduate from college spend a little bit less time interacting with their children than mothers who graduate from high school, because the college-educated women of that era are more likely to be working. Mm-hmm. And this is 1970. But the better-educated fathers are spending more time with their children than the blue-collar dads. And so it evens out. There's almost no difference. Today, in the first year of life, women with college degrees spend an hour a day more in interactive time with newborns than do women who only have high school degrees.
And why is that? Stunning. What is your research showing?
Well, we argue, and this is what we argued in our last book, what we called BLUE is a new model of the family, and it's a new set of pathways into, you know, stable, economically prosperous, middle-class life. And it goes like this. We argue in the 19th century, the big story about the family is the emergence of a better educated middle class. And the family was reorganized so when the men went off to work, the women took care of the home. They used to help out in the fields and the shop and be the basically the assistants to the husband who ran everything. When the men left to go someplace else to work, what you saw was that women became in charge of the children's education and moral instruction. And that was necessary, basically, to keep the men from getting the girls pregnant. You know,
sure, yeah. To keep the girls safe and to keep the boys from getting into trouble.
And I say men and girls deliberately because the view was you've got to keep the boys who are 17 and 18 in school. The age of marriage rose pretty dramatically. The pathway into middle class life became investment in men's education, which opened the doors to the middle class, and by middle class I mean professional, executive, managerial, scientific, engineering positions of the 19th century. But this change, which was a small part of the population, affected everybody. And one of the reasons it did is farm wives in places like Minnesota embraced the new model. By 1900, the U.S. was emerging as the best educated country in the world because girls were staying in school longer. The girls outpaced the boys in terms of education in 1900 and did so in farm communities. And those girls then grew up to hold the line on sex, so people are getting married later, but also to invest in their children's education. What that then supported was greater, we call it specialization among men, as men's education became the pathway into the better jobs.
And now it's changed, right? And how has that changed?
And our argument, where I started was on blue. What we describe as blue is a new family model that says invest in girls as well as boys, hold the line on early pregnancy, later marriage, and marriage at the time when the men and women know who they're going to be when they grow up.
And you're saying that those are the factors that will more likely create a stable family. And a stable family is a bigger predictor of children's success and our country's success.
Yes. So if you then follow through on that model, and I realize I'm being a little bit complex on the causality, but if you follow through on that model and you say the new model of marriage tied with upper middle class success is you certainly don't have the kid until you've graduated, finished school, gotten the first couple of jobs.
Why? Because men don't want to be with somebody who has some kid that they're toddling around, right? I mean, that's the whole point.
That's certainly true. But I'm talking about the women. The women, if they want a good marriage or if they want a good career, either one, should not get married too young. They should hold off. They should invest in themselves. But note, when they then get married at, 28, and they have children, these upper middle class parents spend an enormous amount of time on their children. One of the statistics that are stunning is women today spend much less time than my stay-at-home mom did on housework. But they spend more time interacting with their children, and so do the men.
Yeah, because the house is like a big bomb that went off, but you're still out there schlepping them around to hockey or softball or whatever you do.
I'll tell you, my parents, who were absolutely devoted to us, and my mother, who's a stay-at-home mom, never took us. All those things. When I was a kid, we played sports was something you played out in the street. I did join a sports team in high school, but I don't think my parents ever attended a game. It wasn't the way it was done in that era. No, the amount of time we spent attending our kids' sports games and after-school activities while my husband and I had two full-time jobs, off the charts.
Yeah, so basically, you're also saying that inequality and the changing in the patterns are changing the advantages of children because the people in the upper classes are spending so much more time and giving so many more resources to the children. Whereas
yes.
the other classes just don't have the ability to do that anymore. And whereas, 40 years ago or even 30 years ago, it was different. Everybody was kind of getting the same amount. Now there's a huge difference in what kids are getting.
Right. Let me give you one more example. If you go back 40 years ago, and let's say you have two families, both college graduate fathers, mothers who didn't graduate from college, both stay-at-home moms, and in one case, the father is a school teacher. In the other case, the father is executive, making twice as much money. In that era, there would be no real difference between the performance of the children. the education of the parents would matter in predicting how they're going to do in school, SAT scores, but not the family income. Today, take the same two families, same level of education. Now both parents have gone to college. One set of parents are school teachers. The other set of parents are executives making, you know, several times as much. There will be a difference in outcome, in SAT scores, in school performance that correlates with family income.
And that's because they're getting more time and more resources devoted to them.
Yes, after school programs, tutors, strategizing, SAT prep, being able to, you know, a lot of schools are not terribly good. If you can intervene, monitor the child's homework, figure out where they're failing, bolster the children when they need help. All of that is more important today than it was 40 years ago.
And I remember you, in the book, you were talking about the difference of how you approach going to college versus how you dealt with your child going to college. And I just went through this with my son. He just got accepted to, well, back in December, to Northwestern's engineering school.
Oh,
and,
like
yeah, and he's super excited. But, you know, the difference between how when I went to the University of Minnesota and I got an engineering degree, my undergrad. And, you know, the difference between me and him was I didn't really get much attention. I mean, I didn't really work with the college counselor and my essay. I don't even remember doing my essay. I didn't study for my SATs or my ACTs, whatever I took back then. I just went and took them. And, you know, the difference is that, you know, how much effort we put into it. He went to even though he did really good on his ACT, he still wanted to get 1 point better. And, you know, he went to an ACT tutoring, and his essay we spent a lot of time on, and we visited all the campuses. I mean, it was a big difference in the approach that we took with him than I, you know, that me and my friends took when we were going to school. And it's just changed, hasn't it? How the resources that we're giving our children now.
Yes, and you know, the children where it makes a huge amount of difference are the children who otherwise would fall by the wayside. So, you know, yeah, we have three children, and our first one was very good at standardized tests. So, you know, we did an SAT tutor, and I think it made a small amount of difference for him. But the other two had more difficulty in high school, and we found the SAT tutor was just invaluable in terms of not producing, you know, scores in the 98th percentile, but in helping children feel comfortable with the exam, maximizing what they can do. It certainly made a difference of 100 points or so for children who, if they just walked in, I'm not that good at these tests. And that's where it really pays off. And again, same thing with schools. If you can be there, meeting with the teachers, figuring out what homework is due, finding out and knowing when things fall by the wayside. I will say in California, one of the differences between public school and private school is public school, the counselors have several hundred students each. They don't get the reports in on time unless you're paying attention to the process. If you want to maximize your child's chances in competitive colleges, you have to be involved in that process. When I went to school, when I was in high school, my parents were certainly not terribly involved in my college application process. And the counselors weren't as overwhelmed because not as many children were going to college. And the resources were greater in the sense that, you know, if you needed a guidance counselor, the guidance counselor was there. They didn't know very much about the college application process either, but they got the paperwork done on time.
Yeah. Whereas if I was doing it, or if a kid's doing it on their own without the prodding, you might miss all those deadlines. I could just
That's
see.
Right. That's
I probably would have missed a lot of deadlines. I think my dad was more on my case about making sure I at least got it in. He didn't really get involved other than with that. It was kind of interesting how much he cared about that, which is why, you know, which is probably why I did what I did. But it takes a parent to really get involved. I think, so would you say that marriage is still the path to family stability and children's success in general?
Well, here's the issue. And again, it's teasing out these kind of causal factors. There's no question. When we look at our children and when we look at their friends, that they're, I mean, my oldest son is very social and is now in his early 30s and is a lawyer in San Francisco. I mean, there's a period where he would go to, you know, maybe half dozen weddings a summer, and they'd be all over the country. There's no question that his cohort of friends, he went to the University of Michigan, are very marriage focused, and that marriage is part of the pathway into prosperous middle class life. When you look at why people aren't getting married, though, and especially the people in, you know, that middle, that 50th percentile, who used to be very marriage focused and are less so now, you know, the reason is that they don't see it as contributing to their stability. And the kind of story we hear, I'll give you a couple of examples. My hairdresser back, you know, that I had a few years ago said to me at one point explaining her divorce, you know, I can take care of myself. I always have. I can take care of myself and the kid. It's tough, but I can do it. I just can't take care of myself, the kid, and him. So at the point where she's working full time and her, and, you know, and she's struggling to work full time, but she's working full time. She's the primary caretaker. She's the one running the family. She sees the husband who cycles in and out of the labor market, contributes some time, can't be counted on, as a negative factor to her sense of security.
But it would be, okay, say your because, and then I'm going to ask a question.
Because it means she has to take care of him, and she can't count on him to contribute equally.
Well, and have you found a pattern, and I have some examples here, where if the husband decided, well, I am going to stay home, I'm going to take care of the kids, I am going to contribute to this marriage, but I'm going to do it in a non-traditional fashion. If you're going to have the job, I'm going to make sure these kids are doing okay and that we create a stable family environment. Then it works.
You know, and you know where I see that pattern most? Law school faculties. Every time I give this talk to a law school faculty, that's the pushback. And when we look at attitudes and studies and all this, the better off people are, the more flexible they are about gender roles.
Well, and so it's still the elite, right? It's not.
It's the elite.
Because I, you know, I look at my sister who's a doctor, and her husband decided, you know, he was an investigator, or he was a police officer, and then we went into investigations and stuff. And then he decided, I'm just going to stay home and be with my kids. And then I have a friend, my son has a really good friend whose father, they're from Ecuador, and the mother's an orthodontist, a doctor. And then he's also a doctor, but he's not licensed in this country. And so instead of going back to school, he said, I'm just going to stay with the children.
Yes, and you know, when I watch my cousins, you know, the blue collar version of this is I have cousins who got married not too long after high school. I mean, they're my age, so they're older now, but they got married not too long after high school, and he was a soccer player, and you know, when the soccer career was over, he got a job in Rochester, and she eventually Rochester, New York, and she eventually went back to school and is a school teacher now. And so if you look at it, you would say she's a college grad, he isn't. But he's also a great guy who's been absolutely devoted to the kids. And they always traded off. I mean, he was always involved in the children, picking them up after school. And the trade-offs over the course of a marriage in terms of who does what, who earns more money, you know, they're very flexible about that. But you need, there are a couple of things you need for that to work. You need men and women who are secure in their own skins, who have and feel good about themselves. And you need that kind of flexibility. Now, they're also in a community. They live close to their families. They're part of a large extended family network. There's a lot of support for them personally. And I will say they know who they are. There's no problem with ego. When you look at the men who are in the losing end of the economic changes, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of angst, a lot of angst in the sense of where do I fit? How do I prove I'm a man? If you have a guy who can't hold a job, and, you know, the what we see now is a whole lot of dead-end jobs. The career ladders are gone. Even if you're talking about white-collar folks, you move up often now by looking for the next job, not by staying with an employer for a career.
Yeah, things have changed quite a bit that way.
And so when you're looking at blue collar guys, you're finding, you know, you stay with a place for 20 years, you don't get regular raises anymore, you don't move up, you get regular promotions, there are not a whole lot of benefits. And if the boss doesn't treat you well, and one of the things about blue collar jobs is the boss typically doesn't treat you well, you know, my boss treats me very nicely, but, you know, if you look at how many jobs there are where the labor force, you know, you hire when there's work and you lay them off when there isn't, there are no raises, there are no benefits. When that boss is mean to you, you quit. And when you quit because the boss is dissing you and you go home to the family, the wife's furious because now that income's gone. And,
so you're being treated poorly at work. You're not, your wife is bad because she only sees the paycheck. I mean, there's a lot of hard things that these men are dealing with.
Right. And so there's no security in the home. There's no security in the family. And one of the things that we're beginning to see people talk about, but I will tell you this discourse is in its infancy, is this idea of respect tied to a meaningful social role. So if you see a more unequal world and you see a lot of men who know they're on the losing end of male status hierarchies, they behave badly.
Well, and that's the backlash against women that you see. You see all those comments and all those, you know, all over the internet, you see these crude, really bad comments, and it's them backlashing because of the situation they're in, and they're blaming this on, you know, women and all other factors, when a lot of it's really related to the economy.
Yes, and that's really the thesis of our book. So the thesis of our book is that what's happening is when you look at the top, you see men outpacing women. When you look at the bottom and the middle, you see women outpacing men. That is, and I don't want to overstate this. It's not that the average woman at the 50th percentile earns more than the average man at the 50th percentile. That's not true. It is rather that the wage gap at the 50th percentile has narrowed. Over the last 30 years, women's jobs have become more stable, although I will say nobody's made much of a gain after 2000. But women's jobs overall have become more stable. Women have more opportunities than they once did. Men, the comparable group of men, see declining opportunities and less job stability. But at the top, the opposite is true. So if you look above the 90th percentile in income, the wage gap has increased appreciably since 1990. Let me be clear on that. That means, go back to 1990, that period of the 70s and 80s, women were gaining on men, but women made about the same percentage of the male wage, whether they graduated from law school or whether they graduated from high school. And to the extent women made a higher percentage of the male wage, that is, they were closing the gender gap, it was the best educated women who were making the most gains. Now take what has happened between 1990 and 2010. And in that period, the opposite is true. Overall, the wage gap has narrowed. But now there's a big difference by education. At the top, for college graduates as a group, the wage gap has increased. And if you take, and that means that men are earning more than women to a greater degree than in 1990. And if you take the 90th percentile, that is the top 10% of the whole economy, that increase in the gap between men and women is huge. And now if you look at it and you control for things like education, the number of hours worked a week, you know, different specialties, things like that that affect education. So you eliminate the women who aren't working full-time, etc., and you look at more comparable figures, you still find that the wage gap has increased dramatically.
So basically, it's because men or people on the lower income scales just don't have access to the family, stable family providing jobs. And so it's not inequality per se across the country that is the problem, as much as just access to jobs that create a stable family structure. And that's what we're losing.
Well, actually, we argue something slightly different from that. I mean, the story at the bottom has been that. But we argue something a little bit different, and that is we argue what inequality has done is to change the way men and women match up with each other. And so, you know, the story had been, we started off talking about this, the story had been, okay, so we've got all these independent women, and the problem is all these independent women, the feminists, who have destroyed marriage. You know, that used to be the story. But the problem with that is when you see the most educated women, you see all these liberal elites, they're all busy getting married. There's no decline of marriage in those communities. The women with the most money who are the most independent have become, used to be the least likely to get married. I mean, college graduate women in 1920 were very unlikely to get married at all.
But
and even in 1960, the most educated women did not marry at high rates.
But my girlfriends, who I would say are feminists or not, you know, feminists, it doesn't matter, but the feminist girlfriends who are highly educated are all getting married and staying married. So it's, you're not saying it has to do with that anymore.
No, the only group in society whose marriage rates have increased are the top 5% of women by income. That's a stunning figure. The only group in society whose marriage rates have increased are the top 5% of women by income.
And the rest has fallen.
And the top 5% of women by income have lost the most ground financially since 1990 compared to men.
So you're saying that the bigger the wage gap, the more likely there's going to be marriage?
Yeah, I am. Sadly, I am.
But, okay. But you're also saying a stable family structure is important for the welfare of children, which is important for the success of future generations.
Well, you know, on that, I would like to make it a little bit more complicated. One of the things we found in the book is that these things reinforce each other. So, you know, if your top group, if all those lawyers and judges out there and all of our friends are busy getting married, focusing on marriage, focusing on the kind of qualities that make for a good marriage, you don't cheat on your husband, the husband, you pick the good guy as opposed to the guy who will cheat on you, you're somewhat flexible in attitudes about who picks up the kids, both the men and the women are flexible about who picks up the kids. All those things, they have reinforcing effects. And then you know, I talk to judges who see these couples coming in, you know, who aren't married, had kids together. The mother is not very good to include the father because she found out he was cheating on her, or he's abusive, or he's simply not very respectful, or a variety of other things. And she's cutting him out of the kids' lives. The judges are furious at these women. But when we look at the studies, what we're finding, again, would marriage be better? Sure. But the people who can make marriage work are different from the people who can't make marriage work. And they have some degree of stability in their lives. But we've got a system that, because the elites are very marriage focused, has not rebuilt an infrastructure that supports women who are struggling to raise kids on their own. Let me give you just one very simple example. Flexibility of hours. The better educated you are and the more income you're making, chances are pretty good the more hours you're working, but also the more flexible your working conditions. So right now I'm doing this interview. I'm sitting home doing the interview. I have to be at my office by noon. If I were working at McDonald's, I guarantee you, I could not take the morning off to do an interview and show up at noon. I have to be there at a given time. Professional jobs work longer hours, but they're much more flexible about timing. And so those kinds of things
it's
see.
It's a knowledge-based economy is changing in how we're looking at that.
Right. And we have not rebuilt. So when you look at elites, you have a set of things that elites are doing to rebuild the infrastructure that supports children while allowing both parents to stay in the workforce. When you look at families, working class families, the jobs are less flexible. There is less support for family leave. Child care is very expensive. And the ability to manage that is harder. So what you see single mothers doing is a lot more job instability, where they move in and out of the labor force with family needs, where they rely on family, extended family members who don't provide high-quality child care, where a child's illness may mean they lose their jobs, which in turn holds them back from the kinds of things that would allow them to accrue seniority or build up benefits. And so you're seeing reinforcing effects that are not just about family form, but about the nature of the infrastructure. I guarantee you, if all these elite women were also single mothers, you would see a lot more investment in childcare.
Oh, well, yeah, because they have the power to make a difference. So how do you see this hurting the future of our country?
Well, there's no question. So, you know, we talked about the change in the family in the 19th century. The U.S. emerged by 1900 as the best educated country in the world because of farm families were doing it. And, you know, the investment in places like Minnesota in education, the big growth in secondary education in the United States, free, universal secondary education in the United States was led by the farming, mining, and West Coast communities.
And it fundamentally changed the power structure of our country, and it's really the backbone of what created our success.
And when you say, where did this happen? It happened in the more equal parts of the country. So there were two huge keys to this change.
Was it equal in, like, everyone was making about the same amount of money, or was it equal in the sense that the men were and the families had stable and good enough stable incomes to provide for their families?
But it's actually, I mean, when you go back to the 19th century, because, you know, especially if you're talking about farm economies, farm income has never been all that stable. It's, you know, the instability in agricultural markets has been huge. But I mean equality in the sense that the difference from the top and the bottom in Minnesota in the 19th century would be much less than, say, in Boston or New York. And so when you look at what spread education in the United States, it wasn't the Northeast. The Northeast was richer. And this new family model originated in the cities in the urban Northeast. But that's not where it spread. It's spread in the farm communities. The second thing that's really important were things like land-grant colleges. And do you know when land-grant colleges passed?
When?
1863, passed Congress, the funding for land-grant colleges, which were also very important to the spread of education in farm communities. And do you know why it passed in 1863?
Why?
Because the South seceded. The South had been blocking it.
Oh, wow.
So the South in the 19th century, before the Civil War, also blocked the kind of investments in public facilities, in education, in the creation of a more egalitarian infrastructure for the country as a whole. The South in the 19th century was also opposed to these things. And the Northeast was radically unequal, with immigrant families coming over, that fueled the factories, but that also created a more intense class divide. The idea of a well-educated middle 50th percentile of the population really took hold in farm communities, the Mountain West, and the West Coast, not in the East and not in the South.
So they didn't see, I mean, there's always going to be economic inequality. It has been since the beginning of time, and I doubt that it'll ever really go away. However, they didn't see creating the environment for people to get the skills and the abilities to succeed and make their own futures as something that was important.
Well, you know, it's also this idea, you know, that, and you hear this now all the time. Oh, those people out there who don't finish, who drop out of college or pile on debt, or the people who are in the communities that are poor and have a lot of crime. It's their fault. We're successful because we worked hard, we saved, we got our children through college, and those people aren't succeeding because they, you know, Charles Murray talks about this deliberately. He says, and explicitly, what's wrong with today's society is people should come out of their gated communities, be engaged in the communities, and call the men in poor neighborhoods lazy bums and get them off their feet and back to work. The fact that the crime rates and arrest rates have gone up in those communities is because these people lack a good work ethic, and the only thing preventing them from succeeding is the right moral values. This is nuts.
Well, there's more to it, right? I mean, if and this is what I'm trying to get at, is if the different people had jobs that could provide for the good paying jobs that could provide for the family and they could get their dignity back, then income inequality wouldn't be as big of a deal because they would have the resources to do what they need. It's the fact that they don't have the basic resources and their dignity to do the basic things.
Well, you know, it's a little bit more than that, and this is something where conservatives like David Brooks do get it right. And this is some of, you know, one of the things I find fascinating is there's, you know, when you get past the rhetoric, there's actually in the family economy debate something of a convergence going on. And it looks like this. It emphasizes two things. First, what you just said. If you don't have jobs for blue-collar men, you are not going to see stable families. And you're seeing right and left agree somewhat on this. Maggie Gallagher, who writes for the National Review, has recently done an op-ed saying the Republican Party should embrace an increase in the minimum wage because it is absolutely necessary for the health of the family. This is the National Review. So there is some fascinating things on that end. But here's the other piece. The other piece is the takes a village. So one of the things that good researchers are discovering, and you know, I just went to a talk last week by Harvard professor Raj Chetty, who was talking about Minnesota. And he was saying, look, when we look at social mobility, what's the likelihood a child born into the 20th percentile of families by income ends up at the 80th percentile? You find some parts of the country have more social mobility than others. The entire South has very little social mobility compared to Minnesota. Minnesota does reasonably well. But let's take a look at counties within Minnesota, and Dakota County does much better than Hennepin County.
Well, so the basic point is that the environment that your child's in is a huge factor in whether they're going to be successful or not. And
yes.
Just like when you're managing companies, your culture is so fundamentally important to the success of your company. Good business executives know that creating the right culture is what creates a successful company. So you want to place your child in an environment that is going to create a prosperous, you know, success. And if you put kids into, just like employees and good businesses, if you put kids into the right environments, they're going to succeed even if they come from a really, you know, awful place, because the environment is nurturing and creates a successful thing. It's just like a culture in a business. Except
yeah.
They're not doing it. A
yeah.
lot of these other environments are not working.
Exactly. So, you know, this is what the study showed. Take a child, single mother, bottom 20% of income, and instead of growing up in Hennepin County, spends the first 10 years of that child's life in Dakota County, the odds are good that that child will do better simply by virtue of living in a different community. And let me add one more thing, too. So I have a friend who's doing a study on this, and his description of this is Walmart moves into the neighborhood, test scores drop. What is he saying? He's saying something like this. The studies on plant closings. When a plant closes in a community, the test scores drop in schools. And the test scores drop not just of the children whose parents were laid off, but the children whose parents were not laid off. And there's the boy crisis. Boys' test scores drop more than girls' test scores when the community falls apart.
Well, and we're going through a really dramatic time in our country with the economy being, you know, they put out a report that we're almost at full employment. The unemployment rate has dropped to 5.5%, which I got to tell you, I think it's complete bull. Because the amount of employed workers are still at historic lows. They're hovering around, you know, it should be an opposite effect. The amount of people who are employed should represent the amount of people who are unemployed. I mean, the chart should correlate. So obviously the unemployment rate is being manipulated heavily. So my point is that we're in a really, really hard economy since 2008, probably since 2000, like you're saying. And the reality is that this is affecting our families. It's affecting our children. It's affecting what the environments that they're in. If they, in a factory where the people are laid off, the people who weren't laid off, those children's and test scores drop, just like the people who's in families that were laid off. So it's affecting all of us. Having an environment, having a culture that is messed up affects everybody in that culture. Just like in a business, if you have a culture that's toxic, you can't compete. But when you have a culture that's dynamic and innovative and all these things that help you be prosperous, that, you know, you can take flight. It's like you're not as heavy. You can lift. And it's that same concept all over the country with children.
Yes. Well, you know, and it's one of the things that happened when we got to the end of the book is, you know, our argument was that there was a set of reinforcing forces between the economy and the family. And I do want to just get to a little bit of this and then the solutions. So the reinforcing forces we found is that what, you know, when you look at men and women, the men tend to want to marry a woman, you know, both men and women want to marry partners. And indeed, when we do radio talk shows where people call in, they say, yes, yes. You know, and that is a partner who helps them get where they want to go, as opposed to a partner they feel is holding them back. But you also see, when you see the studies, men don't want to really marry women who outshine them. On the other hand, they want to marry a woman who makes them feel good about themselves. Now, good about themselves helps them feel successful. So as a practical matter, what that means is that the men, and this is a huge change since, say, 1960, is men care a lot about women's income and education. They want to marry somebody who's the same level they are, probably because they want a companion they can talk to, but they want somebody who will support them when they have to work late. They want somebody who understands and is part of their lives. Women, in turn, also want somebody who is a true partner, not somebody they have to support, not somebody who they worry about whether they're going to show up for work or will pick up the kids after school. Somebody they can trust is a true partner. Men and women both want that. So what you're finding is when there are more men in the pool, in the marriage market, and right now in the elite ranks, there are more successful men than women in the top ranks, roughly above the 85th percentile. Then what happens is the women can be picky. The men compete a bit to be marriageable, which requires some mix of being successful, reliable, and respectful to the women. And the women will commit when they find the right man. And this creates a reinforcing emphasis on marriage. It does because the men compete to land the right woman. And to stay married, they need to be faithful. And the women are, I will tell you, are frustrated, especially if they're in New York and D.C. But the women, again,
because there isn't as much, there's too many women compared to men.
Well, but there aren't in the elite ranks. So as you move up, I mean, the real problem is the biological clock.
I see. Yeah.
I mean, all the women of my era who went to D.C. who were successful professionals did get married. And the more successful they were, the more likely they were to get married. I mean, it's very interesting. But the point is they hold off and they wait on having children and they are marriage focused. And this has reinforcing positive effects. At the bottom, though, what happens is when you write off a large number of men as not worth marrying, the women give up on the men. They invest in themselves, their own education. They don't wait. They have the child earlier because they don't really have hope of finding the right man. And when you see those patterns, the woman isn't committing to the guy who shows up sometimes, who's using drugs, who has a criminal record, who can't hold a steady job. Then you find that neither the men nor the women are really committing to themselves, to each other. And when that happens, what you're seeing is the women are creating a different pattern. If you look at African Americans, and some of this is quite fascinating, you see stronger networks where the women rely more on their friends to take care of the kids, you know.
Can that work? Can that be a, if they have a strong network, can that be a means for getting the children the resources they need? Or are we seeing that in those communities that these kids really need the men?
Well, but this is the piece I want to emphasize. What's really different between African Americans and whites, when you're looking at what really is a working class culture, the African American men understand and have internalized that they really want to be fathers. They want to be involved with the children. What's different is they don't see their relationship as dependent on staying with the woman. That is, that they understand that the women control access to the children, and they need to be respectful to the mothers if they're going to see the children, and they need to contribute. But they have internalized a system that says the mere fact that our relationship with the mother, you know, the mother and the father relationship broke up, doesn't mean they shouldn't be involved in the children. Interestingly, you see this with Adrian Peterson. Peterson, for all of what happened, is involved with his children from different with different women, and expects to be. And so that idea that you need to stay involved is longstanding in the African American community, but is new to the white community. So the white working class community used to be either you married the mother or you didn't see the children. Now that's in flux. And so this idea that the father should be involved, but the mother controls access, is something longstanding in the African American community. And the white community, there's a big power fight going on this issue. It's very subtle, it's low key, it's largely invisible. And you have norms within the community that are evolving, and a legal system that is almost oblivious to what those norms are. And so one of the things is that question, is it important the father be involved? And if so, on whose terms? At the top, there's no question the men call the shots. That is, we have a new system that says you get a divorce, you know, you get married, you get a divorce. The father needs to be involved. He has a right to be involved, and the court will insist on it. And that gives the father power, the power to insist on involvement and to enforce it if he has the resources. And women have internalized that notion. You have a child with somebody and he's not a sperm donor. He has a right to be involved, and you are supposed to encourage his involvement. In poor communities, the mothers aren't marrying because a lot of the men, you can't trust them. I mean, again, drug use, criminality, simply unreliability, unstable behavior.
There's a lot of cultural issues.
Right. And that's from my communities too. I mean, the working
class. Well, there's cultural issues everywhere, but.
I want to emphasize this is for the entire working class. You're seeing more bad behavior by men as their role in society erodes. But.
And it's based on the economy, not having good jobs and not being able to have their dignity. And then that's their way of acting out.
Right, and these have mutually reinforcing effects that are destructive to family stability. Now we go to the question, what's the solution? And, you know, when we got to the end of the book, we were a bit frustrated because the solution is not in family law. We have lots of proposals on family law, but we have no illusions it will do much about the family. Instead, what we have been looking at much more closely is the structure of employment. Here's one of the biggest things. You hear employers in the U.S. all the time complaining. In fact, the Wall Street Journal runs at least a story a week saying, why has manufacturing left the U.S.? Because manufacturing depends on stable supply chains and a stable skilled workforce, and the stable skilled workforce doesn't.
Oh, that's BS. Manufacturing is leaving because it's cheaper elsewhere. But anyways, yeah. Keep going. I really believe that's why business people are business people. They're going to go to where they can get it for the least amount of money.
Here's my theory on this.
Okay.
I think it's tied into the changes in the financial system. So I have a different co-author who does a lot of work on employment. We've been looking at this, and here's our theory on this. When you look at tech Apple, and Apple doesn't have that many total employees in the U.S. compared to General Motors. It does have a group of highly compensated engineers in Silicon Valley and Microsoft has the same group in Seattle. But when you look at the move from the iPhone, we go from from the Mac to the iPhone to the iPad to iTunes to all of these initiatives, you don't need that many employees to do it. And when you gear up for production, you hire some factory in China with whom you may not have an affiliation when your current production schedule is done. Compare that to making a car. There's all this discussion in the Wall Street Journal. You know, can Apple make a car? Can Google make a car? And our suspicion is they can't. Here's why they can't. You need a big factory with a trained workforce and set supply chains. If you're going to lay off your workforce at the first hint of a recession, it's not just that you lay off people and you rehire them tomorrow. Your skilled workers go elsewhere. They're not there. And when you look at what Wall Street has done, and there's some really interesting stuff on this, you look at the pressures that come from Wall Street on short-term bottom line. What's the easiest way to goose the books so you meet your earnings schedules? Lay off a bunch of workers. If you're in the tech field, you know, you can offshore, you can do a variety of things, but you keep your core workforce, which is the
Well, you keep your knowledge base here.
Right.
And then you offset your worker type, you know, the grunt labor, shall I say. I shouldn't say grunt. I don't know how to tech right now. I don't have a good word for it, but the knowledge stuff stays here.
Right. But you can't do that with manufacturing. If GM hadn't been bailed out, the conventional wisdom is this is the end of automobile production in the United States. Why? Because of the sunk cost. To reassemble the supply chains and the skilled workforce is difficult. And you need greater stability, economic stability for manufacturing than you do for tech or for service sector positions.
But manufacturing in this country is so much more expensive. And you could, for example, I'll give an example about IKEA. I built and ran a company here, and I was talking to one of the government people that were trying to figure out how to bring more manufacturing into this, you know, into our country. And he's like, it's so hard because we can set up a factory to create chairs, for example, and we can pay the employees nothing, zero. And it's still more expensive for us to create the chair than what they can, than the, what they will buy it from us for. So we can't make any money. So it's almost impossible for us to compete against China and some of these other countries because their infrastructure costs are so much less than us.
Well, you're not spending money on it. But you see, that's the public-private partnership that needs to be there. So we're not investing in infrastructure. We know that it's crumbling. When you look at the stimulus, which was supposed to invest in infrastructure, some of the things, you know, again, you had the stimulus rewritten to satisfy conservative demands with much more emphasis on tax relief. But tax relief provides less stimulus than infrastructure spending. And infrastructure spending takes time to ramp up, and it takes a commitment over a period of years. We don't have a political system that produces that. But I want to get back to the jobs, the stability in jobs, because we're arguing, and I have a new piece coming out, and it's going like this. We're moving toward a financial system that ties to firms that have networks. And what I mean by networks, I love your example on you know, making a chair. You know, I've been looking for sofas. And, you know, sofa companies now, you've got somebody in a room someplace at a computer. And, you know, you're when I look at sofas, you have Italian leather, which is a style of manufacturing that may not come from Italy. You've got
exactly
a frame that's made with hardwoods that might come from Malaysia or Thailand, depending on the year. It is assembled in either Romania or China. And you have somebody at a computer so that you have a fluid network that is continually reassembling the pieces. Well, when you have that, you don't have stable employment anyway.
No.
And you don't have investment in workers.
The only stable employment we have now is knowledge-based workers. That's where, and that's probably the upper end of the economy. The one thing that can change some of this is 3D printing. And that's a whole nother topic. But if you get to a point where you can, you know, manufacture things in a different types of ways, we just have to rethink how our economy works, because we have to create jobs for people that provides a living for people.
Well, I do want to add one more to this, because we've been struggling with this question of what to propose. And one of the things we see, I mean, you notice that Walmart has announced a raise for its workers. One of the things that is different, and I, you know, Paul Krugman and other people talk about this, but one of the things that is different from when I was growing up is we used to have this idea of a full employment economy. And you ask the question, what's a full employment economy? Well, it's a combination of fiscal and monetary policy that leads to a demand for workers that puts pressure on wages. So you have some inflation. Inflation is not a bad thing for workers. So if you think about it in terms of paying off student loans, you know, I paid off my student loans with dollars that were a lot cheaper than the ones, you know, what I borrowed, the dollars with which I borrowed the initial money.
Whole governments have got out of debt by inflating out their debt.
That's right.
There's, you can argue both sides of that, but.
But if you look at the wholesale attack on the idea of stimulus spending, the never-ending drumbeat that says we have to raise interest rates, the Fed effort to prop up the economy by keeping interest rates low. If you think about that, that's class warfare. That is a set of attacks that, you know, and I leave to you the macroeconomic policies. That's a huge, complex discussion. But I've been interested in how does this affect the jobs that support families. And when you listen to that discussion, what you hear is, again, a wholesale attack that I guarantee you is funded by an economic elite, a wholesale attack on policies that would lead to tighter labor markets, that would persuade employers to invest more in employees. You don't need to invest in employees if we've brought back the reserve army of the unemployed, which we have. And if you've got these activist investors who will attack companies that are good to their employees at the expense of quarterly earnings. And so, you know, the companies, there's a wonderful show, I was listening in Minneapolis, of companies talking about how hard they worked not to lay people off during the recession. But these companies were small businesses. You know, they made those. They weren't.
They figured out how to do things like, okay, maybe because when we went through the hard times, what I did is I said, okay, I sat down with my whole manufacturing team. And I said, in order to keep everybody employed, we're going to have to do a rotation here where you work 30 hours a week. And that way we can keep people employed. And then as things get busier, then we all have a job. But it's better than saying, okay, you're employed full time, but we're going to lay other people off. And everybody agreed to it.
Right. And I hear that. I mean, you know, there's a new book out by somebody who ran a steel company, one of the larger steel companies in the United States, and he did the same thing. And one of the differences between steel companies and some other, and for that matter, steel companies and window manufacturers and any number of small businesses is you need your workers. But if you're running a large company and you're a corporate executive and you're asking the question, what is your bonus going to be this year?
Exactly.
And how are you going to fend off the activist investors? You don't need your employees.
Well, you're not close enough to the base to understand the value.
That's right. That's right.
There's too much of a gap between you making the decisions and the value of the people doing the work, and you just don't see their value. And so you're making decisions that help your bonus versus what helps your company long term.
And I think what that does over a long period of time is it means that you see the industries locating and staying in the United States, like tech, that have a set of knowledge workers who, because they're in high demand, you know, because the demand for them is high, the investment in them is high, and the employers treat them well. And so you see those kinds of companies in the United States who have the ability, as Apple does, to recreate itself through a set of international connections. So it's fluid. It invests in a small cadre, small in terms of numbers, of knowledge workers. And everything else is flexible and can be offshored. The kinds of enterprises that depend on a large cadre of skilled workers aren't flexible enough to withstand, I think, current conditions in the U.S. I think that's as important. And then the commitment to infrastructure is a matter of public spending and public-private partnerships.
And get out of the way. Spend the money on the infrastructure to support the business, but then get out of the way when you're not supportive and you're just messing people up. So be wise enough to know where you're helping and wise enough to know where you're not helping. And it's detailed.
Right. And I mean, if we wanted to talk about small businesses, there's no question, you know, you look at who the Tea Party is, and small businessmen are very high on the list. And why? Because anybody who's had to deal with government regulation hates it. And, you know, what you see are these large companies with their armies of lobbyists gets preferential treatment, but small businesses don't. They bear the brunt of government regulation that is often more complicated than it needs to be because of the role of lobbyists for large corporations.
But, and they also, large corporations might purposely make it bad so that they can get those small businesses out of there. So it's not always, it's pro big business to have regulation so that the small businesses can't handle it. So it's governments need to be wise enough to know when they help and when they harm, and know when a big business is taking them for a ride versus helping them. And that's why you need more, I think you need more business people in government who understand what's going on and knows when a lobbyist is just, you know, taking you for a ride.
Well, but we have, so the bottom line on this, you know, there's no question. I mean, what I am excited is I finally see the conservative pro-marriage people saying something we've been saying for a long time, which is when you're looking at the working class, that marriage and the ability to hold a job are deeply interrelated. And you're seeing people, because the pro-marriage people have argued for a long time that the decline in marriage is really hurting children. Now, we have more mixed feelings about that. We do find, and I think the evidence is indisputable, that stronger marriages and more family stability helps children. Whether it's causal or it's because, you know, communities that have stronger marriages tend to be stronger for other reasons, I think the jury's out on that. But I think there's no question in the society that currently exists, more stable families means higher level of overall investment in children, who are more productive adults, that's good for society, and we're destroying those connections. If you're going to fix it, you have to bring back stable employment for blue-collar workers. Now, you can educate them. A lot of people talk about education, but I don't think more education is a solution without more jobs. And you only get more employment if you have tighter labor markets, which increase prices, and you have a wholesale attack on the macroeconomic forces and the infrastructure investment that would give you more stable jobs at higher prices for blue-collar workers.
They need jobs that they can support their families and have a higher level of dignity. And we need to make that a priority and not see it as a bonus because we can get labor for cheap.
Right.
We have to rethink about what it is. If we, just like Ford did when he wanted a lot of middle-class families bought the cars, and that built our country. And the big businesses need to look at it. We need more strong, stable families to buy our products and to educate our, you know, our kids will get educated. There'll be more innovation. Everybody will be more prosperous versus, oh, this is a bonus because I can get employees at a cheap rate. They need to stop looking at it because all we're doing is racing to the bottom to become a third world country. Right.
Yes. And I would emphasize this is something the sociologists don't emphasize, but we do. And it's the idea of stability. Stability in families connected to stability in employment. So again, what we're just talking about, I mean, when we look at it, all the incentives, again, are to think of your firm as a network. You're sitting behind a computer. You know, you're going to offshore this to China this year, but next year China is getting expensive. We'll go to Thailand instead. You know, we buy the hardwoods 1 year from Malaysia, the next year from Thailand. We look at Romania if we don't like the working conditions or instability somewhere in Mexico. If you think of that fluidity, that's utterly disruptive of American communities. You need investment in communities that produce stability. And you can do it one of two ways. You can change the incentives for businesses to commit to the communities they're in, or you can create public-private partnerships that keep flexibility but take workers, and when they're laid off one place, retrain them for someplace else. But you can't do it through the private market because the private market right now is dominated by Wall Street with a focus on the short term and the bottom line.
Well, and that's been our problem all along, and is that Wall Street's always focused on the bottom line and the short term. And, you know, small companies that don't go on Wall Street look at it from a much longer term perspective. And that's why your investment needs to be in small businesses and Main Street, not Wall Street, because Wall Street's just a short term throwaway focus. And Main Street's a long term community focus. And if we want to build our country, you can't do it by investing in Wall Street. And that's all we've been doing is investing in Wall Street. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing, because Wall Street cares about short term and Main Street cares much more about long term. And we've kind of left mainstream in the dust. And that's what is happening at a macro level.
Yes. And, you know, so what's exciting for us, and I keep emphasizing how stunned we are, is that left and right disagree on a lot of things. Right now, there is a growing consensus by people who care about the family from right and left that you need to focus on employment and you need to emphasize, again, somewhat higher wages and more stable working conditions for blue-collar folks.
Because they all see the problem. They all know that the problem is the families are unstable and they're crumbling. The left and the right have a different philosophy on how to fix it. The how is different than the what. But the what, which is the families are struggling, and in turn, the children are struggling. And that's a huge impact to our future. And so we're all coming together saying, oh my gosh, we got to fix this.
Yes. Yes. And so that's exciting. Where I see no progress is on what would fix it. And it's because, as you know, what we tried to write about in our book is, you know, it's not one thing. It is a set of reinforcing things in which people then develop different coping mechanisms. And those coping mechanisms are pushing classes farther apart because they're moving in opposite directions. We don't understand each other terribly well. Whereas when I was growing up, you know, the differences between being an inner city kid in a working class neighborhood, moving out to the suburbs, which we did when I entered high school, the differences in assumptions about family were not very, very great. But today they are.
Yeah, there's a big difference in cultures and I think just the economy being so messed up, for a better word, lack of a better word, is really creating a lot more divisions and a lot more extremism on all sides. So are you seeing any backlash from your book?
Oh, all kinds. I mean, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we present this to law school audiences, the big pushback we tend to get is, first, that we are too marriage-focused, so that, you know, our colleagues on the left want to say marriage is not the solution to anything. And in truth, we're kind of ambivalent about it. That is, we do think it's family stability. And in the United States, that tends to correlate with marriage. We also are not saying necessarily that what's going on in poor communities is not adaptive. In fact, what we think is going on in poor communities, and this is certainly the most controversial conclusion of our book outside of law schools, is that marriage is a bad deal for poor women. That women paired with unreliable men have more power outside of marriage than inside of marriage. Why? You've got a guy who runs up the credit card debt. If you're married, you're responsible for his debts. If you're not married, you aren't. Completely separate.
So basically, anytime you're with somebody who's a liability, it's not as good. But if they're not a liability, then woohoo, if you're an asset, it's positive. If you're a liability, it's not.
Right.
It's pretty basic.
And, you know, when you look at poor men, I mean, one of these statistics are really quite striking. So the law in a lot of places for parents who are married, parents who aren't married, and custody is pretty much the same in a lot of places. But here's the thing we discovered when we really looked into it. Let's say your family, not a whole lot of money, you know, the man beats up the woman, she decides this is the end of the relationship. If they're married, she needs to go to court. She needs to get a divorce. The court it's expensive. Not that expensive, but if you don't have money, it's expensive. And the court is going to insist that the father have a custodial order that gives him time with the kids. And the more time he has with the children, the lower his child support obligation. You're not married. All you need to do is get him to move out of the house. Now, if he wants to see the children, he either has to keep the mother happy, which is what men in poor communities think. You've got to keep the mother happy, you want to see the kids. Or he's got to get himself to court. He needs to bear the expense of going to court, paying the court fees. He needs to get an order, and he needs to enforce it. The burden is on him. And when you see
So there's an incentive with law not to get married, the way things are set up right now. Because, I had a friend who, she is great, but she got herself and messed up with the person who's not the best mate, if you will, and they got married, and he ended up being a drug dealer and probably the biggest one in the whole part of this twins, probably in the state. And, he was smart, but he didn't use his smarts the right way. And the effort to get out of that marriage and to get her kids away from that really toxic environment was really, really, really brutal. And so that's a good example of how the system really works against the families in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. You see in the sociological literature, a lot of women are saying, well, I don't believe in divorce, that's why I'm not getting married. And middle-class people look at that and say, that's nuts. But that's not what she's saying. What she's saying is what you just described. If I marry the guy and he gets arrested or he runs up the bills, my credit score is going to be destroyed. I might get arrested because of something he did that he stashed in the house, or I might have to go through a big fight with him about the kids. I don't get married and the same things happen. I can just leave. Or he can go off to prison. It doesn't affect me very much. And typically in that case, she's got a choice. She can cut him off from the kids, or they can work something out where he sees the kids, but she's calling the shots. If they get married, she faces a much harder time disentangling herself, and he has more power. But note, he's not pulling his weight anyway. Whether they're married or not married, she's the one who's taking care of the kids. She's the one who has the stable employment. She's the one who's paying the bills. So, and that's true either way. So when people say that, I don't want to get married because I don't believe in divorce, what they're really saying is divorce gives men power. And I don't want that. I don't want to give the guy power over my kids unless I trust him.
Well, and so it makes sense. It all comes back to the basics of human behavior, trust, all the cultural issues of trust being stable, the factors that our economy is breaking down. It's creating a lot of emotional poison for people when they don't have dignity. And it almost becomes kind of an animalistic environment because they're just trying to survive. And so we have a lot of ills going on in our society that we need to fix.
Yes, when people do studies on who succeeds on probation, what's interesting is they're probation success stories. And what they do is they get the people who are coming out of prison minimum wage jobs. Our audience said, well, how can you get jobs for people are in halfway houses when you can't get jobs for the ordinary public? And the guy who was doing the study said, well, employers who are only willing to pay the minimum wage, if you can guarantee somebody who shows up every day for a minimum wage job, they'll hire our folks. And it turns out you take ex-inmates, you give them a job, you subject them to regular drug testing, and the condition of staying out of prison is they show up for their job 40 hours a week. Those people do well. It cuts the recidivism rate dramatically if they have structure and accountability in their lives. And they don't. Simply having to show up 40 hours a week for a job improves the life of almost everybody.
Yeah, because you have structure. You're forced to be responsible. And that's why marriage, the stability of marriage, and people can argue that marriage doesn't matter, but marriage creates stable an environment that you're responsible for others. And that's what a family does too. People become a lot more responsible once you have children that you have to take care of, and everything stabilizes.
But you see, that's the problem, is that the men who feel that pressure, Kathy Eden has a new book out with Tim Nelson called Promises I Can Keep. And one of the fascinating stories she tells is the guy who, he's with a woman, she gets pregnant. They don't know each other terribly well. She cleans up and finishes her nursing degree in response to the needs to take care of the child. She's putting a lot of pressure on him to clean up. He's got a minor criminal offense, but it means he can't get a job. And he deals with that pressure by dealing drugs. When he deals drugs, he's bringing in a lot of money, and that money makes him a more respected part of the family. But it also undermines his stability. He's at risk of arrest.
Well, the problem, that's a complex problem, because we have an issue where we have so much incarceration in this country. And then once you're incarcerated, you have a mark, defamation on your resume, and you can't get a job. So now it forces all these people to do things that are not stable producing. And, you know, that gets into the problem of the prisons. We're just incarcerating people that maybe shouldn't be, and we're by far the highest in the world. And we have to relook at that. I mean, there's so many issues that we can dive into, but it all comes back to a culture issue. It's like a war on the poor, kind of. And we have to look at it from a, you know, looking at it. I don't know if people are religious or not, but, you know, Jesus did say one thing, and you can't ignore that. And when he said that there's always going to be poor in this world and you have to take care of them, and that's what he means. You should not do things in a culture that hurts others and creates a cycle of poverty, because there will always be the poor that you need to help. And you should live your life like that. Whether you're religious or not, that teaching is really strong, and it's really fundamental for a strong culture. But,
well, you know, I'm on the board of an institution that's looking at policing in Minneapolis, and there's going to be a new report coming out soon. One of the things it's going to find is why are there racial disparities? And one of the answers is, you know, they're looking at which police officers issued the most citations. And this is what they're finding, and we're finding this nationally too, that what we did is, again, this is the accountability model that we've heard for the last 30 years. You've got to have incentives. So the incentives for police officers are you get paid more, you get more overtime, you issue more citations. What's the easiest way to boost the number of tickets you get, the number of citations, the number of low-level misdemeanor arrests you make? You go to the communities where you can arrest people who won't fight back.
That's awful. That's so awful.
Yes.
Because, you know, they come to me and I'm going to fight, right? I'm going to argue if they give me something that's not right. And they don't want to have to deal with that. And if my kid gets arrested, I'm going to go fight for him. But that's sad. But that's the way we're feeding on. It shouldn't all be about money. We've gotten to a point where, you know, the police force needs money. Everybody needs money. So how do we, we have to look past that. And how do we be more prosperous? Money now does not mean money later. And we have to rethink how we're doing this. You know, I've been reading, some of the critiques that you have in your book, and most of the stuff I've seen has been really positive. I haven't seen, as you probably see the negative critiques more when you go and make presentations and things, and, you know, the backlash, but I've seen a lot of really positive critiques. But one thing that I thought was off the mark, and I'm going to read this, is that one of the critiques they said about your book is, this is of interest to anyone who cares about families in an era of increasing inequality. And I would say that that greatly misses the mark on what all this stuff is about. I think this is about the basic needs of the next generation and whether we are providing the resources to be prosperous as a country and to rethink what we're doing. And I thank you so much for providing such in-depth research for people to look at and to really think about what we're doing and why we're doing it. Because, you know, our children and how we manage our children and the resources that they get is what our country is going to do later. And we have to remember that when we built this country, we built it because we had a strong middle class and people who could buy the products. But what your research is showing, that our middle class is really struggling. And, you know, they talk about the jobs that they're not getting and why they're struggling. You know, it's always talk about, you know, the middle class is disappearing because of the jobs. But what they're not seeing is behind that disappearance is all these casualties and how much that's going to affect our country. And this is what they mean. this is how a great nation turns into a third world country. And We need to really look at that.
I agree.
And
I agree. This has been terrific. I really appreciated your including me.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing this with us. I think this is a really good read for people. Very dense with research information and a very good read.
We so often look at the day-to-day, and people have a hard time zooming out and looking at the big picture and looking at the future and thinking that the day-to-day issues are so much more important. And, you know, let's face it, the day-to-day issues really are important. But if we're not looking at the welfare of the future generations, then we are really doing a disservice to this country and to everything that we built. So this is an important topic that, and a very timely topic that I think that our leaders need to focus on, and we need to get serious about how to solve some of these issues. So for now, let's have a wonderful day.